on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 85. We're keeping an eye on rapidly shifting security issues with a roundup from this week's Munich Security Conference.
The difference between Munich and, say, Davos or other large conferences is that in Munich, you are looking at a very intimate kind of event. Everybody practically knows everybody else in the room.
That was Ambassador Wolfgang Ischinger, chairman of the Munich Security Conference. We'll also be looking at security issues across the Med with our editors.
2011 for the Middle East is panning out to be a revolutionary year. I mean, Tunisia, no one expected it. Now Egypt, who's next?
That was Monocle's Beirut correspondent Carol Corm, and we'll be getting a preview of this week's Aero India Aviation Show with Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine.
The one thing that manufacturers have learned over decades of dealing with India is that nothing happens in a hurry. So there'll be a lot of horse trading, a lot of lobbying going on.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, February 6, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, and Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound, and also our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Who let you in?
I don't know. I just sort of followed the crowd.
You came to the coffee hatch, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Has it been a busy week on the foreign desk?
It has, yes. Yeah, I got back from Muscat in Oman. Oman, not Amman. And which is going to be in the new issue.
It is.
And then, yeah, a busy week of editing and fine-tuning.
And watching Frans van Capten, watching Al Jazeera, and watching, well, I mean, many news outlets, and we'll be talking a little bit later about all that's happening, not just what's been going on in Tunisia, but of course in Egypt throughout the week. But before we do that, hello, Andrew.
Hello.
You felt left out, didn't you?
No, I was enjoying that. I was enjoying the chat. You know, I don't mind the focus being on Steve for a minute. As long as it comes back here now, thank you.
It's not been a busy week for you, though, has it?
Hold on. Actually, I've been feeling like kind of a very kind of kind parent this week, because I've sent the kind of some of the people from the office to Sydney to do a story.
You are so angry about that.
I think I made a wrong decision. And it was too late when I saw them checking in for their flights to Sydney.
Yeah, they were already sort of, you know, comfy in their seats on Etihad, weren't they?
Yeah.
Why did they go on Etihad?
It was just so they could sample the Middle East on the way. No, they, I didn't
just dip their toe in Abu Dhabi.
It was just convenient. But anyway, yes, we're doing our first kind of big project down in Australia. So we've sent a kind of team of editors from London. And when it's kind of grey and cold in London and you know it's sunny and warm down there, suddenly you do get a bit bitter.
Yeah.
You're not the only one who's bitter. Everyone is bitter.
Yeah, I think the whole editorial floor is quite angry. Rob, are you angry? Is that your... Actually...
I'm more angry that no one's noticed that I've had my hair cut.
It's because you've got the headphones on.
I've got my headphones on.
Yeah. It's sort of like an Alice band. Keeping it all in place.
And what's strange is you went 9 months last year without one haircut, and now you've had like two in reasonably quick succession.
I've gone bananas. It's because I like the massage they give you.
Do you go to my place?
Similar. It's Japanese, but it's not the same outfit.
You go to Moriyama, don't
Moriyama.
You?
Yeah, it's good.
My joint's changed its name.
What's it called now?
Well, that's just called Graffiti. And I just sort
it's
of
called
think,
Graffiti?
I know, it's not very good.
That's a bit...
Because someone's going to do something sort of strange with a razor to the back of my head.
Is it a tattoo parlor as well?
It might be.
You hear some buzzing and screaming in the next door room.
Yeah, I don't know why they rebranded as Graffiti as a Japanese salon. Anyway,
well, hold on for a minute. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've been not far from you. I've been one floor above. I've been quite busy reading pages all week. Okay. You failed to mention that we did our first ever travel guide. We were doing a travel guide to Taiwan. Did you know that? Did you miss that?
Well, the reason I know that is because on the final round of fact-checking, I discovered that every Taiwanese person has a slightly different view on how you should spell every word.
But thank goodness the government had a view as well.
Yeah, so they had a very strict phonetic kind of ruler that they slapped down and made us measure up to.
Excellent.
What did that feel like?
I said, come back again.
And it looks good, though. It's a new format. We like Taiwan a lot. Rob, you've been...
I've enjoyed it.
And you've not been?
No, I've never been.
Have you been?
I've never been, no.
But it's it's a place that we like very much. And
I feel as though I've been there.
You've lived it page by page by page. Yeah. No, but it's got all the things we like. It's got a wonderful sense of scale. It's incredibly cozy. It's got that right mix of a little bit of China, a little bit of Japan, a little bit of everything else going on. Good pop scene, right, Rob?
Mm. Yeah, and I like the architecture and things. And it's still a big Asian city with lots of kind of quiet green corner, genuinely green, almost jungly corners. Obviously, it's in the middle of a jungle.
The words higgledy piggledy come to mind.
They do.
How do you say that, Andrew? In Mandarin.
See, that would be almost like, that would
be easy.
That wouldn't be very good, I think, going on air trying to do a fake Chinese accent.
No, let's not.
I don't think that's the kind of thing that ends up on YouTube.
We'll do it during the break and make sure we're recording.
I'll be forced to resign within the week. Plus, it would sound like Welsh anyway. But anyway,
exactly. Anyway, this weekend, Munich was once again the center of attention for international security policy as the 47th Munich Security Conference took place. 350 senior decision makers from all over the world convened, including UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But what were the major themes after a week of dramatic changes across the Mediterranean? Ambassador Wolfgang Ischinger is the chairman of the conference, and he joins us on the line from Munich. Hello, Ambassador.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. I wanted to start, in terms of the theme of the conference, or certainly the lineup of your conference, you've slightly been hijacked by North Africa, perhaps.
Well, yes, indeed. You know, I have inherited from my distinguished predecessors a policy of not releasing the official program of the conference until a day or so before the actual event. The only reason we've handled it this way in the past was to make sure that we would retain the necessary flexibility to react to last-minute events, and such a last-minute event seems to have occurred over the last few days, and first in Tunisia and now in Egypt, etc. So I am currently trying to examine options to make sure that while we do not wish to drop any of our classic foreign and security policy issues, which we have put on the agenda, we're certainly going to try to make sure that these burning questions, that we will be able to offer ample time for discussion of that and even provide one or two or three speakers who are competent, either because they may come from the region or because they are knowledgeable about the region. And I dare say that both categories are amply represented in Munich, so I think we will figure out a way to do this.
Very good. I want to come back to the situation in Egypt and Tunisia in a moment. But I guess there's some classic themes, some broad themes. Afghanistan, issues of cyber security, which are perhaps constants at the moment. And I'm wondering, are there specific areas, maybe turning our attention to cybersecurity first? It seems that so many nations right now are looking for benchmarks and wondering if there is a best practice approach and if there is real leadership in this field. And I'm wondering, is there a nation that we can look to right now which really has the right type of policy in terms of fighting, which is obviously a very elusive target?
Well, there are obviously some countries that have spent more time, more energy than others on exploring the risks and dangers inherent in the cyberspace issues. And some of these countries are those that have been affected by cyber-related activities. Think of Estonia, think also of Georgia, think of a few other countries. My own view is that it is about time for a specialized senior-level annual meeting like the Munich Security Conference to highlight cyber issues. I would have hesitated to do it a year ago, but now, after the publications surrounding the Stuxnet phenomenon, referring to the Iranian nuclear centrifuges, etc., etc., it is my impression that in almost all relevant capitals, there is now an increasing awareness that this is not science fiction or just a concern about the possible stealing of data which ought to be protected. This is about much more. This is about the conduct of war by other means. We are talking here about the possibility of inflicting huge damage to the infrastructure or to the core of a society and to bring about exactly the same type of damage and panic, etc., that in the traditional sense, the classic application of the instruments of war would have produced. So this is a brave new world in a way, and we need to examine it and hopefully start developing rules about this new era and this new sphere of international conflict.
Ambassador, I'm wondering, at a conference like this, and perhaps not unlike Davos, hot on the heels of Davos, where, of course, many people get very excited about the keynote speeches and some of the debates that happen on stage, but when you have 300 to 400 people from the military, from various foreign ministries, etc., assemble in Munich, how important are the breakout sessions, the coffee breaks, for people to obviously, not just share war stories, but also talk about best practice. And I mean, I'm wondering how much deal making or how many bridges are also built during Café Klatsch.
Oh, absolutely. For some of my participants, this is probably the single most important aspect of it, maybe even more important than listening to one or two keynote speeches. You see, the difference between Munich and, say, Davos or other large conferences is that in Munich, you are looking at a very intimate kind of event. Everybody practically knows everybody else in the room, and everybody is for 2 days in the same room. This is not a conference where you may start wondering whether you have chosen the wrong panel. Maybe in the hotel next door, there's something more interesting going on. That's not even possible in Munich. Everybody participates in the same plenary discussion, and people are sitting together in a packed ballroom in this hotel for 2 days, which means that everybody gets to talk to everybody, and that's what makes the Munich atmosphere so special, so informal, so useful for so many foreign ministers, prime ministers, defense ministers, and other senior officials from the Euro-Atlantic world, but also beyond, because increasingly we're getting senior officials from Asian countries and from other parts of the world to come to Munich.
Ambassador, it's Andrew here. I'd like to just ask a very simple question. Against the backdrop of most governments kind of slashing their spending and slashing their spending on defence as well, are you concerned as people gather this time in Munich that the participants will obviously be keen to do everything they can, but they may be representatives of governments who are less willing now to kind of spend on security?
Well, absolutely. And I think this is one of the important new issues which we need to address. What are exactly going to be the consequences of the financial crisis on global security and stability? It is not good enough, in my view, to bemoan the fact that military budgets in the United Kingdom or in Germany or elsewhere are going to be, you know, less grand than they used to be. As negative as that may appear to be, in my view, it is far more important, certainly for Europeans, to begin asking themselves the question, well, if we know that there is no way that we're going to be spending more on defense in years to come, how can we possibly get the 27 members of the European Union, for example, how can we possibly get slightly more bang for the buck? How can we develop synergy effects which have so far been totally untapped? Is it really necessary for each small European Union member state to provide the entire spectrum of military capabilities? Or should we not go in the direction of, you know, let's say where the Austrians provide mountain troops and the Danes provide the submarines, or something that would make sense in order to share the responsibility in a more meaningful way and in order to create more effectiveness? It is not okay that Europe spends almost half as much as the United States on military expenditure, but gets only one-tenth or so in terms of actual military fighting power out of this investment. This is not good enough. And I think, in this sense, the crisis offers not only reasons to, you know, to bemoan our reduced defense budgets, etc. It is also a wonderful opportunity to start thinking about creating synergy effects, about pooling resources across Europe, across NATO, and I think we could be a lot more effective in just a few years' time. Fortunately, the British and the French government and a number of other governments, including my own, have started individual pilot projects in this direction, but I hope we can work to accelerate the awareness that the time has come for Europe to think in terms of one effort instead of 27 totally unconnected and separate efforts that are going to be costing just too much.
Ambassador, hi, this is Steve. On that similar theme, obviously there's been cuts in Europe, but there haven't been in other countries in the East, you know, in particular China. Do you think we're starting to see a shift of global military power away from European countries towards the East?
Well, I certainly believe that this is exactly the case. I don't think that in terms of overall military power, the special role which the United States has enjoyed for the last number of decades will be questioned. I believe that the United States will continue to play a very singular superpower role. But there is no doubt that because of the economic growth rates in other parts of the world, the relative weight both political and economic and military, of continents like Europe will tend to decline, not the least because of the demographic changes, which are already known, not only to our statistical offices, but to our political leaders. So quite obviously, tectonic changes are beginning to take place. Power relationships are shifting. The Pacific Basin is going to gain in terms of relative importance. Brazil and other countries are also going to play a much bigger role in the future, as will Turkey. It's quite obvious. And Europe and the United States, I believe, are well advised not only to seek to reinforce the relationship which we have built over the last half century in NATO, but we, I think, also should, in our own interest, seek new forms of cooperation with other countries in the North, including, for example, the Russian Federation. There's no reason that I can think of why, for example, in terms of ballistic missile development, the United States, Europe, and Russia shouldn't pool their resources. If it is true that we do not look at each other as adversaries anymore, if we mean that, what we have been saying for quite a while now, then the obvious next step will be to pool resources and to accept the fact that we're facing the same challenges and to spend our money jointly instead of against each other.
Ambassador Isner, thank you very much. And please look after your cold as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment with Beirut correspondent Carol Corm and foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London, where it's Middle East Maghreb Affairs time with our Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm, along with editor Andrew Tuck and foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. First, Carol, I wanted to ask you, why aren't you in the thick of it? Why are you in London?
I have projects to be done here. projects.
Right, which do take a long time if it involves builders in London, right?
Involving boilers, driver's licenses, a lot of things.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to that probably a little later. We'll also come back to, you know, oddly, you know, if we were rewind two weeks ago, you know, certainly when we saw what was happening in Lebanon, they seem to be the quiet story at the moment.
Yeah.
In light of everything else. Feeling a bit left out even.
Everyone's actually very happy. They're like, thank God everyone has stopped looking at Lebanon and are focusing on Egypt. And I think that's what we need right now.
Your view, you've certainly perhaps not been the biggest supporter of Mr. Mubarak, but I don't want to get into too specific details, but you know, we saw what happened in Tunisia. We're seeing what's certainly unfolding in Egypt at the moment. Does this become a house of cards for all of North Africa, do you think? I mean, you know, you only have to go down to Yemen and everywhere else, and everyone's getting quite excited.
It's just interesting. 2011 for the Middle East is panning out to be a revolutionary year. I mean, Tunisia, no one expected it. Now Egypt, who's next, you know? And everyone always thought that when a dictator is overthrown, people like Ben Ali or Mubarak, or everyone thought it would be the Muslim Brotherhoods. And this is what these guys have been selling to the West for years. And what's kind of good news is that it doesn't seem to be the case. You have other figures that are popping up, and they're not extremists. So I think it's very positive. We should be happy.
It was interesting listening to a gentleman from Al Jazeera, one of their news anchors, was giving a spokesperson for Mr. Mubarak, you know, quite a hard time. And it was, you know, this gentleman was saying, listen, there are millions of people, you know, in Egypt who want sort of what has been seen as stability. And no, they're not out on the streets protesting, but there are supporters. The anchorman said, well, we know, where are they? I mean, they may not be on the streets, but we don't hear from them. But do you think that there are, you know, there is a sizable, you know, people think, well, it hasn't been great in Egypt, but, you know, better the devil you know.
Well, that's what Mubarak has been trying to sell to his people for 30 years. But it seems like the Egyptians are ready to take the risk. They deserve it. They've had 30 years of not such a great time. The policies of the government don't reflect the people at all. So if we have someone like Baradei who comes in and makes a good transition, why not? I mean, 30 years, it's time to move on. Or as the Egyptians love to say, game over. This seems to be the line.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of Egyptians clearly who've like certainly been watching, I don't know, a lot of American sport on an Arab satellite channel or attended some liberal arts college. Steve, just not every nation and, you know, as Carol said, if everything is potentially up for grabs in the region, there's not a Mohamed El Baradei for all countries. And I mean, is this probably, you know, whether looking at, you know, what might happen happen in Tunisia at the moment, or elsewhere. This is, obviously cause for concern.
No, you're right, there's not. And I think actually that's one of the reasons why Tunisia still isn't actually a proper revolution as such. It's been very, very slow and steady. Some of the old figures are still around. And one of the problems the opposition had in Tunisia was there wasn't an opposition. Mm. There was no unifying figure, as Baradei has appeared to become now in Egypt. Although, even he was criticised by a lot of Egyptians for, being very careful about what he was saying before this crisis happened. And, he wasn't even in the country when it happened. But if you look at other countries, whether it's Syria or Jordan or Yemen, there are no opposition figures that people can coalesce around. I think one of the interesting things about, looking at the coverage, and you asked, does Mubarak have any supporters? When the so-called Green Revolution was happening in or Green Movement was happening in Iran, in the West, we thought, well, how has he sort of stayed in power here, Ahmadinejad? Because, all we're seeing is all these demonstrations. But all the Western media was in the north of Tehran. They weren't in the rest of the country, where actually some people did find Ahmadinejad quite popular. Here, a lot of the coverage has been, the best coverage has been on Al Jazeera, who know exactly what they're talking about. And they know that, when they're saying, there are protests all over the country and people hate Mubarak all over the country, it's true. Although one thing on Al Jazeera's coverage, I'll be interested to see if there's fighting or disturbances in Qatar, whether they're as keen to cover it as they are in other countries.
Mm. Andrew, I want to pick up on just the media coverage point, because we come back to this a lot. On one side, sort of the decline and the cutbacks, and this comes off the back of a week where we saw significant cuts at the BBC World Service. But yet, again, it almost seems that Al Jazeera comes of age, certainly in a part of the world, where they are very well resourced. They, of course, have a huge Cairo bureau, not just, Arabic language, but also, English as well. On that side, do you think that this is just, in a way, makes the likes of whether they're Skies or whether they're BBCs or certainly CNNs, look a little bit out of step and slightly under-resourced?
Yeah, but the only interesting thing is that if you're too effective at your job, then you kind of draw flak. And that's certainly happened for Al Jazeera. They're the ones that the Egyptians, they're the ones that are picking up and putting, trying to get off the streets and trying to close down, because they know that they're good reporters, but they're believed in the region. And that's, I think, the reason that they've been targeted by the Egyptian government. I also, what I quite like about the coverage for all the stations is, that every station has their kind of, their big daddy and their big mummy who kind of get flown in when So our friend Lise Doucet is, who's an amazing reporter. But you just, it's okay, kids, out the way. Here comes John Simpson. Here comes Lise Doucet. And then you have these amazing voices, and then and there's something really wonderful about hearing those old school, really great reporters being authoritative. And they actually, listening to Lise Doucet, just, she has a way of wrapping together a story and talking to people that's actually just really good to listen to. It's great when you see the quality of some of the reporting that's been going on.
And the other side as well, because it was interesting how gritty Al Jazeera gets. And I'm not sure if you saw this, while you were running around a home base at the weekend, Carol, but they did this doorstepping number, Al Jazeera, on Mubarak Jr. So this is sort of the other side of saying, well, also we have a big bureau a big presence in London as well. So they're almost sort of doing sort of the Sky News tactic as well, sort of, running around Knightsbridge, trying to track him down. I just want to go back to Lebanon. Certainly all eyes have been on Cairo at the moment. But what's the word back home, and what is happening? And everyone just keeping a lid on something. And in many ways, do events in Egypt, in many respects, also keep a lid on things in Lebanon for the moment?
Well, right now, I think it's a little bit wait and see. Our new prime minister, Najib Miati, is trying to form a government. Whether March 14th, the pro-Western Hariri bloc is going to join is a big question. I hope they do. And that's it, really. Not much is happening. And for once, not everyone is looking at us and waiting to see what's happening. We're looking at Egypt right now.
Mm. Has there been a sense of unease that people have up sticks, that people have just said, I'm going to maybe just spend the next 3 weeks, and even if I didn't have a holiday in Stad booked, I'm going to go there, or I'm going to go off to Singapore or somewhere else and just wait things out, or is everyone staying put in
no,
Beirut?
No, people are traveling. I bumped into some people on the street in London, actually. I think people are just waiting for things to settle down, because right now the government, there's not much happening, no decisions are being made. So people are going skiing or whatever they're doing.
I like that international because people are traveling at the moment. Yeah,
they are.
Andrew, just on this, do you think that, you know, if you were a government, let's say go to the far side, whether you were looking at at a Morocco, and certainly we saw things flaring up on the streets of Amman and also in Yemen as well. If you are let's say a Hillary Clinton who's been very much guarding her words, I'm wondering how busy are your foreign missions at the moment, and your key negotiators and deal makers. Do you think they're quite busy at the State Department at the moment?
I'm sure, and I think what's intriguing about both Tunisia and Egypt, and also there have been some ructions in Amman in Jordan, is that actually, on the face of it, here are three countries actually reasonably wealthy. They have a large number of unemployed, but they their GDPs actually look quite good, that they have got good foreign backers. They had a kind of a pretense at kind of a reasonably liberal kind of attitude. And it's these countries where actually people have realised actually that isn't enough, that actually people want political freedom as well. And that's what Mubarak has kind of counted all the time, that he could get a little bit more money in the economy and he could sell bread cheap and that would be enough to kind of pay people off. And it's funny, it's interesting that these revolutions have sprung up there, not in Libya, not in Saudi Arabia, not in actually the tougher, more autocratic states. It seems a bit quieter. It's the ones where
because it can be, though.
Yeah, but also I think that what's interesting is it's that taste of it. People know that it didn't take too much to push to kind of start demanding political freedom. And it's also just fascinating. I know Steve doesn't quite like the word, but it is that fascinating thing about how a revolution can be contagious. You look at what your neighbour's done, and within 2 weeks, as collectively as a nation, you think, actually, let's have a revolution as well. This is the time. And it's funny that you need that spark of someone else doing it.
Mm. Sorry, Steve.
And oddly, one of the strangest sparks in all of this was a tiger in a cage. The WikiLeaks revelation for the US cable from the ambassador in Tunisia, pointing out the lavish lifestyle of Ben Ali's family and how his son-in-law had a tiger in a cage. And that was one of the things that, when it was then printed in the Tunisian papers, started these protests in the first place. So it's maybe a minor victory for WikiLeaks, and maybe the only way that the US has actually played a role in what's going on here. Because, that's the other thing that's interesting, is they've really been, everyone's saying, well, what's Obama going to say? What's Hillary going to say? It kind of doesn't matter. It makes very little difference what they're going to say. Mm. All this is kind of happening with the US at least one step behind.
Well, and what does matter is they ate the tiger as well, if we're to believe the story anyway.
Oh, no.
Did you not hear that?
I didn't read that bit.
Yeah. They grabbed the tiger and then they ate him.
Oh.
Yeah. I want to go back to, Steve, just your point. We were talking about not just, the coverage, but it has been interesting watching the various networks, and I think also how they point their cameras. And on one side, I found that sort of Al Jazeera has been quite good at sort of covering everything. I did feel that when I watched some of the Western networks, when they were looking for comment, it was mostly veiled women, and it was men
or
men with certain facial hairstyle as well,
or Western tourists.
Or the other side.
There's been a whole host of stories this week of
lots of English
British tourists,
lots of
English
teachers,
Egypt terror.
Yeah, who might starve.
Hey, but Cairo Airport is pretty chaotic on any normal day. So right now, it must be really quite terrible.
No, but it was interesting as well, Andrew. You said there was that moment when obviously they had to get people into position, and I think we did rely on a lot of people who were working for small scale NGOs, etc. Who had to be the voice of what was going on. And then, as you said, then suddenly John Simpson arrives and Lise Doucette and Nick Robertson from CNN and all of the elder statespeople are there who can and the satellite dishes. And I think this is what's been very telling about all of this as well, is actually there hasn't been a lot of crappy coverage via Skype. This has been sort of an upgraded to this is a serious flashpoint, and therefore it demands open satellite lines at all times.
Not just even the big guns as well. I've had 6 or 7 emails in the past few days from freelancers saying, oh, I'm heading to Cairo, let me know if you need anything. As it happens, we have a very good Cairo correspondent, Jack Schenker, who's slightly battered and bruised after spending a night in a police van, but is all right, who's been doing a very fine job for us.
I was just going to say, what's interesting as well is how literally the camera angle changed over the days. On day one, everyone was on the 17th floor, looking down over roads or of freeways. And actually the kind of the gunshot, you couldn't actually tell whether the smoke from it was just a bit of smog or if anything was really going on. And it was actually the confidence of having people like Lisa Set and John Simpson on the ground that actually the camera angles came down. It was only after 2 or 3 days that you felt that you were in the crowd and you knew what was going on. And that's again, the kind of the what comes with the ambition of those people, I think.
Steve, I'm not going to hold you to this, but at the beginning of the year, we asked you to look into your crystal ball, and I could see you didn't bring it back today, but, you know, and, you know, you said that the dominating story for the year ahead was going to be the economy, you know, which it is in some markets. But I'm wondering, are we going to be living with, you know, the Middle East and you know, certainly we haven't seen the end of this, but does this, you know, as things warm up as well, do you think this, you know, we ride through summer with this?
Yeah, thanks for reminding everyone that my predictions aren't quick. I still think the economy is going to be the abiding issue. And no, I didn't predict this, just like everyone else.
No, but to defend you, I think no one was expecting this. Even when it was happening in Tunisia, everyone was like, yeah, whatever, it's not going to happen.
Hold on, we do have the interview with Al Barabat.
Yeah, should we
issue this issue?
This is true, exactly.
I did commission that interview, so yes. You know, that makes up for it slightly.
Andrew, give it another plug. What do we have in this issue?
We have an interview potentially with the next president of Egypt.
Mohamed Al Barabat, indeed. I mean, what I would say is it would be amazing if 2011 was the 1989 for the Arab world, but I think it is still too early to say if that's going to happen. Things like this can happen and they don't end up in revolutions. You know, Tiananmen Square, you know, looked like it could have been a revolution and obviously wasn't. So, I mean, it's possible that this sort of thing will rumble on throughout the year, but yeah, I mean, any prediction would be foolish.
Carol, another word in Steve's defence.
Yeah, I think the rest of the dictators in the Middle East are going to tighten up the grip even more. So maybe.
So this means that they're not going to be on their gin palaces in the Met over the summer. They're going to be staying home. I'm not going to hold you to that. I'm just actually a comment on your people. I'm wondering, do things tend to, you know, get a little more hot tempered as the temperature goes up, or is there precedence that actually people are a little bit more lethargic in the summertime?
No, people get excited in the summertime. Things are moving.
Which means that everyone else is going to be traveling. Carol Korm, Steve Bloomfield, Andrew Tuck, thanks very much. Rob Bound is here next with Culture. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Back in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time to hear from Robert Bound.
That was quite a build-up.
Wasn't it?
I don't know. I feel like I should be a movie
What do you
trailer.
Have in that notebook?
You've got
some business cards, I can see.
That was earlier.
Some flash cards. Okay.
Some
flash cards,
yes.
Facts, it looks like.
What sort of facts? Do faxes come in colour?
That's a good question.
No one can really remember, can they?
No. I miss the whir of the fax machine.
I hope there's someone from Canon or Epson.
I know we still have a fax machine.
And the reason I know is because Jack Schenker, our Cairo correspondent, is having to file by fax.
I like
there's
that.
No internet in Egypt.
Yeah.
You keep going on about Jack Schenker. It's just like a drinking game. Jack Let me hear Jack Schenker have a shot.
Exactly.
Yeah, but did you not know about this?
Andrew, in the new office, are we having telexes installed?
That'd I be think nice.
And sort of just kind of a nice sort of, you know, buzz and hum and clatter, you know, of a... But what are they called? It was a ball, wasn't it? It was a kind of a ball printer on a
That's right.
telex machine, wasn't it? Was it?
Well, I believe it was. But my
oh please!
No, hold on.
Don't pretend that you used to work in newsrooms that were all digital and flat screens. I mean, my goodness.
Okay, I can reveal literally how old it was when I first started in I'm not that old, but you know, actually, I am quite old. But I started just literally my first job, and they'd got a computer put in like that week, and it seemed very exciting.
And just one for the whole newsroom.
And everyone was really pissed off about it, and there was all these pieces of paper around which had the column widths for you to type your story up so that it was in exactly the right column width. So they knew how many words to fit in. How about that?
That's quite extraordinary.
But still, that's why when anything goes wrong in the office with the computer, I'm always like, could you help me, please?
No, but Steve, you missed this. Rewind 4 years ago. And this
is completely
no, but it's
without necessary.
Yeah, because you know, we were setting up the office and, you know, IT had ordered all the computers. And just, I'll bring my computer.
Oh, I love that.
There was this, remember, it was...
It's like
it was
an Arga.
Yeah, it was a suitcase. No, it was a suitcase size Toshiba. It was bronze. And it had two hot plates on it.
Yeah.
So you could have a cup of tea on one side and you could have sort of, you know, boil in a bag pasta on the other. So Andrew could sort of do like lunch for himself and everything.
Probably multitasking.
It was amazing.
I like the idea
of
the first ever...
Should go in a museum.
It isn't a museum. It was bought for me by a collector.
Right.
Okay. I'm not the most technical person. I've never pretended to be the most technical person.
I had a big hole in it from a triceratops.
That's what young people are for.
Exactly. Pterodactyl dropped it.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to hear about two new great things in the music world?
Okay, sure.
He literally said no.
No, I don't want to.
One is Cults. They're a duo from New York.
Okay.
And it's sort of, I think you could
Two men? Two women?
Man and woman. Mm. I think you could call it bliss pop.
Oh.
But here's what it sounds like.
What was that called again?
Go Outside, it's called. By Cults.
Yeah. I liked it.
They're quite good. It sort of reminds me of Asobi Sexy, that quite good Japanese band. Mm. Half New York, half Japanese.
I was thinking, it also reminded me of bits of Dubstar, but
with
a little bit more sort of interruption in the background.
Yeah, a bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that called interruption?
Dubstar at sea.
Yeah.
That's what you call that. Are you there? Long wave. Yeah. Listening to our long wave. I was also asking for Andrew to ask if it's been played at the right speed.
Andrew, did you like that?
Oh, God. Right. That's it. I'm going home. No. I quite liked it, but it was a bit 60s, I thought.
Yeah.
Sort of
good. That's why I asked you if you liked it.
Do up.
I'm not in my 60s yet. There's nothing wrong with being in your 60s.
From the 60s. You're a child of the 60s.
Yes, I am. Okay. Hold on.
As am I.
Your boat hasn't pushed out that much further from mine. We're the closest in age to this lot.
Anyway, oh my god! I didn't realize this was going to happen.
God,
can I get therapy after this?
That was a punch up on a Sunday morning. Steve, you
lovely.
Can I just say one thing?
One more thing. Just go for it.
How old does it make you feel? We had someone apply to come in and work with us this week, who was born in 1993.
Whoa!
No, not possible.
1993.
Yeah, they'd be 18.
Yeah.
And we said?
He said, not on your life. I'll feel very, very old if you come in.
You said, how do you feel about clearing the dishwasher?
No, but isn't it? Someone writing for work experience was born in 1993.
Mm. That's good.
Yeah.
It's
right.
The right age. I mean, you know.
It is quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Steve, you like that?
I did, yes. Mm. We should have it on the office.
Okay.
Instead of... Oh, no, sorry. I'm not going to have a go at Andrew. He's had too much.
Okay. Do you have anything else for us?
That's thing one. Thing two, I thought we'd play. Our friend Martin Creed, who's in my Art Basel Miami Beach film.
Mm-hmm.
We showed him on that film playing the guitar.
That's right.
And some people said, I wonder what he sounds like.
Oh.
Luckily, he has a new single out.
Okay.
It's called Thinking, Not Thinking. And it's punky and amusing and kind of short and sharp. And here he is. I was thinking... Wasn't thinking. And then I was thinking.
I got it.
What do you think he was thinking?
No idea.
Okay, that's to make two of us. But
that's exactly.
Fine.
It's nice. I'm not going to rush out and buy it.
No, but it's nice to answer reader queries.
Yeah,
the viewing several.
Is it meant to be an artwork or is it meant to be?
He sort of takes everything. Sort of is a different thing. So a painting exists as a painting and is done like a painting. And
can we have David Byrne back on the show?
Yeah. Well, say yeah. Yeah. I think
we should. I miss him. Do you know that his CD is sold very well in the shops?
The Fatboy Slim collaboration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great
record.
Number.
It's a great record.
It is very good.
It's nice.
Andrew, you like it, don't you?
I love it. I play it all the time. I like it. I like a good opera kind of based thing. I was going to think we could have it over the years. We could have mixed in. We could do our own CD of people who have other jobs because we had the singing architect or the DJing architect.
Oh yeah, Thomas Toivonen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've got the artist singer.
Yeah.
I think we need some more.
We should have some more musical guests, don't you think? Yeah. It's great the contribution of you. You know, playing the stuff.
Do you want people in here?
if there's enough seats.
Okay.
We're moving to a bigger space.
We could do that. Can we get guitars?
Yeah. It's going to be right under your desk. I mean, not right one floor below your desk. We're not building a few egg cartons and a little door under your desk.
If it's down there, as long as it's well air conditioned, I'm fine.
Exactly. I think that's it for culture for this week. Rob Bound, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll see you at the end of the show.
Okay.
Okay.
See you later.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. This week, Asia's largest air show is set to take off. Now in its eighth year, the biennial Aero India showcases the latest launches and developments in aerospace, defense, and civil aviation. Joining us now on the line is Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine, for a preview of what to expect at the show. Hello, Murdo.
Hello. Hi.
Now, you're just across the way from India. You're in Dubai at the moment. But, you know, clearly, I guess over the last 2 weeks, and I think perhaps you broke the news first, that India is responsible for placing what has now turned out to be the biggest aircraft order in history for a new batch of Airbuses.
Yeah, absolutely. And this really shows the rise of Indian aviation. It's been in the doldrums for the best part of 20 years, struggling with a very over-regulated state system. And that's been liberalized. And really, the demand for air travel in that country is now just really coming to the fore. It's a huge country, a rapidly emerging middle class and business class that needs to get across the country and fly abroad as well. And Indian Airlines, while not quite perhaps growing at the pace of Chinese airlines, are probably the second biggest growth market in the world at the moment.
For an event like Aero India, is the focus on the likes of, you know, whether it's, you know, of course, Airbus, you know, landing, you know, a huge order? Is it also time then for Boeing to make, you know, either a big civil or military announcement? Because, you know, traditionally we've seen, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from, you know, the focus is always on making these announcements, you know, around Farnborough or around the Paris Air Show. But is this also from an ego, you know, point of view, from a national brand point of view, is this part of the reason, why these events are so important for the major players? Say, look at, you know, we're investing and we want to win big contracts in your country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think these shows such as Aero India are a little bit different to the likes of Farnborough and Paris, which are sort of truly global air shows. These are very much regional or country air shows where the focus is very much on the Western manufacturers coming in there and making a big play for contracts, whether it be big military contracts or big airline contracts. And the military side in India is massively important. You've got a country where defense budgets are being squeezed almost everywhere else in the world. India is one place where they're not. And you've got a country that's keen to spend more on protecting its interests and modernizing its military fleet.
Is this also something of a power play? Because we've seen that India has purchased a number of new maritime patrol aircraft from Boeing. They're going to be one of the lead customers for this order. Is there a power play certainly between Russia, and the US? Because it seems that India's happy to go both ways, as it were.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, India's one of these countries that I think as the has swayed as the political mood has changed between both blocs. And back in the Cold War, it probably veered more towards Russia. It's always played the Pakistan line with America. After it tested a nuclear bomb, of course, there was an embargo on defense experts from America and most of the West. So it turned towards Russia again then. So it's in a position where it's pretty neutral, really, and we've got a contest going on in India at the moment for this, what's called the medium combat aircraft, where we've got six different manufacturers, including the Russians, including the Americans, and including European manufacturers as well, all competing for probably the biggest military export contract that there's ever been.
And when you look at a contract like that, does that mean that it also, inevitably just, given the state of India and what happens with the Indian government and the protectionist stance, that these have to turn into joint ventures as well, that you'll have to get into bed with Hindustan or one of the major manufacturers to do a joint manufacturing deal?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, offset, as it's called, is a huge part of any Indian military purchase, and you can see why, because they've got an indigenous domestic industry that they want to nurture, that they want to bring up, and it's not quite developed enough, as we've seen with some examples where they've tried to develop their own aircraft and their own engines. They haven't quite got the expertise to do that on their own, so they have to do it in partnership with outside companies who've got the experience and got the expertise in doing that. The Western companies probably, yes, of course, they would rather just sell product off the shelf to India, as they would anywhere. But I think they all accept that there has to be a substantial amount of industrial partnership that goes on with this. And that's interesting because it's not only the value of that in terms of the monetary value, but there are also, of course, security implications and how much of your very, very sensitive military technology you want to give away to a country like India.
Mm. I mean, military aside, though, it's been interesting when you reference China. Of course, just the extraordinary growth that we see with passenger travel, but also the joint ventures that have been struck. You know, Embraer somewhat successfully or not, but also if you look at, you know, certainly with Bombardier, with Airbus, you know, all of them very much involved. You know, in China, do you think we'll see, you know, at least the same type of things happening on the civil aviation front? And you know, and obviously I imagine that the Indians off the back of it are looking for, you know, within the offset, some type of technology transfer as well.
Yes, I think that will happen, but it'll happen in a slightly different way to how it's happened in China. China has been much more about almost tokenistic outsourcing of manufacturing. It's about creating jobs, but not necessarily massively high-value jobs. That's changing slightly in China. I think with India, what they're very, very keen on is real jobs, so to speak. It's jobs in engineering. It's jobs higher up the value chain. They're not just interested in having a factory bashing out bits of metal that's going to employ some low-value workers in their thousands. They're much more interested in high-value engineering jobs.
Finally, just before we go, are there any, I mean, aside from, and I guess probably the announcement won't come in terms of the medium fighter at this show, but are there any, you know, big expected announcements, you know, whether it's going to be from a jet, you know, or from an Air India or anyone else?
Well, I think the one thing that manufacturers have learned over decades of dealing with India is that nothing happens in a hurry. If you remember the Hawk contract that with BA that took, I think, 20 years to resolve, I would be surprised if there was an announcement on the medium fighter at the show. There might be some hints dropped. It might narrow down a little bit. But the Indians, for good reason, because this is a very, very important contract, will take their time on this. There's a lot of politics internally in India, a lot of different parties and interest groups involved. It's not just a sort of top-down decision by the government, by the defense minister or whatever. So there'll be a lot of horse trading, a lot of lobbying going on, and it probably will take a long time for a decision to be made. So not expecting any big announcements at the show, but we will see things moving along quite a bit.
Great. Murdo Morrison of Flight International Magazine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London. We're back in a moment with this week's monologue. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for this week's monologue. Here's our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, sharing his observations on his recent spate of trade fair hopping.
The start of the year sees a particularly high concentration of trade fairs in Europe. If design and fashion is your bag, it's possible to spend the entire of the first quarter fair hopping from one to another. Perhaps a bit extreme and taxing on your sanity and feet, it's an interesting exercise to see how different cities cope with the sudden influx of extra visitors. I've been to 3 fairs in the last fortnight in 3 different cities, and seeing how the city infrastructure is tested has been more interesting than any new product launch. It's not just a mark of how well-suited each city is to hosting such an event. It's an indication of which cities are primed to hoover up the added business opportunities inherent in hosting an extra few hundred thousand businessmen from one industry. It indicates which cities are poised to grow, and conversely, which are at breaking point. I started my own fair jaunt on home turf in London. a city that just next year will host the Olympics. By comparison to the world's biggest sporting event, the fair I attended was just a tiny two-day lighting trade fair. But it was enough to test the surrounding infrastructure to its limit. The local tube station was like a disaster zone. Combining rush hour commuters with fair attendees brought it to a standstill. And above ground, it was a similar tale. Traffic ground to a halt, and queues for coffee snaked outside local joints, where staff inside were huffy. Through my eyes, this was embarrassingly predictable. Were I a businessman visiting from abroad with money to invest, I would be striking London off the list pretty quickly. I next went to Cologne for the annual furniture fair IMM, the first of the year and the biggest in the Middle European market. Record attendees and exhibitors both point to signs of recovery in the furniture industry after a difficult few years. Cologne wasn't in such a promising state, though. There wasn't just no room at my inn, there was no hotel room in the entire city. Though restaurants and bars and public transport bent over backwards to accommodate their guests, the fair has grown too big for Cologne, and the city felt full to bursting. The result was that people who wanted to attend simply couldn't, and those who did will take away memories of a Cologne that is struggling to meet their needs. Next year, it's likely they'll take their business to Stockholm in February, or Salone in Milan in April instead. From Cologne, I travelled to Munich, number one city in our recent quality of life survey, and needless to say, this was a different story. Hosting BAU, the world's biggest building materials trade fair, was a breeze. Hotels laid on special shuttle services to the fairground. The subway was equipped and staffed to cope with an extra influx of some 250,000 visitors. Restaurants sped up their service to cope with as many covers as they could, seeing extra bodies as extra income, not an inconvenience. In short, Munich is a city that works in a way that London really doesn't at the moment, and it has the capacity to expand, unlike Cologne. As the economy begins to pick up, it's entirely possible that a new clutch of fairs and cities will emerge as the important ones to hit on the circuit, and likewise that fairs formerly considered vital will gradually recede until their host cities are in a better shape to cope. For Monocle, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
And that was our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Andrew, do you feel bad for him? I mean, I felt sort of sad when he was just thinking, you know, him sort of, you know, waiting and suffering in Cologne.
When there's no room in the inn.
No, God.
Oh, couldn't even get a coffee in London.
I don't know what's worse.
Oh, my God, bless him.
The tube was like a disaster zone.
I know.
No, but it is interesting to see that impact of a trade fair on a city. You know, when you're at something like Salonia, Milan, although I'm sure it is very efficient, the thing that I always find just so nauseating is those cities where they know that there's these 2 weeks a year where they can just ramp up the hotel prices.
Yeah. So pull up the new menus.
Yeah. When I was at Salonia, we stayed in a very, very average hotel, and it was literally the kind of price of a suite at the Savoy or something. It's just they go nuts to kind of cream the money off you.
Did you ever do the fair circuit as a cub reporter?
Not really. I used to go to the fairground. I did, used to be the Big Dipper expert.
That's what they called you.
You did a consumer test on the size of the goldfish that you could win.
Can you imagine Andrew as the cub reporter traveling around with his big IBM Selectric?
I used to hover on it from fair to fair.
Exactly.
Michael J. Fox.
I'm glad I don't have to do the fairs too much anymore.
You do, well, you don't, you only do the ones you like, don't you?
Yeah, I do, exactly. I do it my own way. Oh, well.
And Rob likes an art fair.
I think an art fair, though, is different from doing
taps.
From doing bathroom fittings and everything
building
else.
Materials, yeah. Lights. Yeah.
What could we send you to, Steve? I mean, aside from sort of the odd, you know, foreign policy conference, I mean, we...
I don't know. We can think of some things.
I think we'd find some, right?
Yeah. I don't mind. So long as, you know, I can find a hotel room and I can get a coffee.
Yeah, you already put your hand up for APEC in Honolulu, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Andrew, did you sign that travel form yet?
Hold on. When you went to Oman, he was very excited that they had a hotel with a kind of a plunge pool. That was the most... That was the best.
I didn't even get to
use
it.
Oh, there's a plunge pool.
I know, you know, but everyone in our company loves a water slide.
Well, that's a sort of remedial bath.
We all love staying at Emirates, but I think that's where the corporate retreat's going to be, Emirates Palace. Yes. Yeah, in Abu Dhabi. We can all fly on Etihad.
No drink.
No, yeah, you can drink by the pool.
Can you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's...
Or you can drink the pool.
No, but that's why then it's fun to jump on the water slide afterwards.
Oh.
Yeah. They've also got ones with inner tubes, and I think you'd like it.
I didn't know that Emirates was a drinking hotel.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. I'm pretty sure we had, they called it wine at lunch. Anyway. It could have been lemonade. No, it is, absolutely.
Okay.
Anyway, off we go. Gentlemen, thanks very much. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alexander Mills. And our sound engineer, big applause, he's back, Chris Sharp.
Chris Sharp.
Sharpie's in the house.
Sharpie is in the house. And he is rather sharp at that, isn't he?
Very sharp.
Yeah.
Like him.
I thought he was going to say something from beyond, but he's not. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us, most of us, daily via our monocolumn on our site. And also, you can even see some of us on our new TV program on Bloomberg.
I know.
Andrew, some people are very upset that, when they watched you on our site, you dropped off, I think, the third segment. But for some reason, we don't play the show.
I thought you fell asleep.
No, you didn't fall asleep. No, but you just dropped off, not nodded off, in segment three. But you can also watch the show in its entirety on Bloomberg as well, but also our site and their site. And it's on both Saturdays and Sundays. Next week, we're still in London. But then we're off to Asia. Woo. Not you. But Hugo,
but you are.
But Hugo's joining me as well.
When you say we, yeah. You mean
me and
I.
Hugo.
Yeah,
me and Hugo. We're going to be doing a program from Korea. The first time, in fact.
Cool.
But that's all for this week. I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Robert Bann.
Goodbye.